Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up with just a week and a half to go until the midterm elections, we'll check in on a tight congressional race in Illinois.
But first, members of Parliament in Canada breaking into sustained applause as 58-year-old Sergeant-at-Arms Kevin Vickers, dressed in a long green robe and ceremonial hat and carrying a golden mace, walked the halls of the building and then entered the House of Commons, fighting back tears. Yesterday, Vickers shot to death the gunman who first killed a soldier at Canada's War Memorial and then sprayed a flurry of bullets inside Parliament. Glenn McGregor is a parliamentary reporter for the Ottawa Citizen. He's at the studios of the CBC in Ottawa. And Glenn, what a prolonged, emotional morning. What was it like for a Canadian, as a Canadian, to see that?
It was very dramatic. You know, our MPs in House of Commons, we have essentially three main parties, and they are most of the time very adversarial. They're going at each other every day. And today, they had a rare moment of unity, and it was very touching. Our Prime Minister, who is not a very emotional person, gave a very moving speech in the House of Commons, and after it, he came across the aisle that divides the parliamentary chamber and actually embraced, hugged the leaders of the two main opposition parties, too. Yeah. So it was something we haven't seen in, well, ever, really.
Well, you mentioned Prime Minister Stephen Harper's address. One of the first things he said is people should get help if they need it. You know, yesterday was traumatic. What's it like for people?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. Yeah. He suggested that and pointed out to these MPs, a large number of them who were actually in lockdown through most of the day here on Parliament Hill, because they were having their caucus meetings, which is a weekly meeting of all the parties where they plot strategy. And this was the caucus rooms were just outside the hallway where the gunman was eventually shot by the sergeant at arms. So they heard the noise, and it's going to be very traumatic for them. And the first thing the Prime Minister said was that you should all take some time to relax and talk to a doctor if you think you need it, because I think there probably will be some people who have some lingering effects of the trauma of this.
Sure. Well, what is the thinking about what happens now after attacks in Ottawa and Montreal, where an ISIS follower hit and killed a soldier with a car? Here's some more from Prime Minister Harper today.
Even as the brave men and women of our armed forces are taking this fight to the terrorists on their own territory, we are equally resolved to fight it here. We live in dangerous times, yes, but the mission of our country and the work of this Parliament goes on.
Now, Prime Minister Harper is the leader of the Conservative Party. His politics, according to many reports, are often compared to George W. Bush's. And he said he would tighten security at home, including new powers for CSIS. That's the Canadian Intelligence Agency. So tell us more about what you heard.
Yeah, the Prime Minister making it pretty clear that some changes that have been in the works to give CSIS, our intelligence agency, this is our equivalent of maybe the CIA, a little bit of like the FBI as well, that they would be given increased powers to do surveillance on Canadians through a network called Many Eyes. So this is an international network of electronic surveillance, which the United States is also a participant, New Zealand, Australia as well, they would have more powers to surveil Canadians who are abroad. And the particular target are Canadians who we think are leaving our country and going to the Middle East to join up with this group, ISIS, or other groups that are similarly inclined. So it looks like more powers for surveillance. And of course, there's going to be some tension with people who feel this is an infringement on their civil liberties. Canadians do not feel quite as passionately about our civil liberties as you do in the United States, but it is a concern. I expect the changes that he proposes will not be approved unanimously by the opposition.
Well, and the Liberal Party leader, Justin Trudeau, is already warning, we should remember who we are. We are a welcoming nation, warning against too much tightening of security. But after yesterday, you know, perhaps some Canadians will be welcoming the tightening. But meanwhile, what about abroad? Canada has committed jet fighters and other military assets to the U.S.-led mission against ISIS in Iraq, but not in Syria. Is there thinking that it might expand to Syria?
I think the government is going to see this as an opportunity to get a wider mandate from Parliament to increase our military presence in the region in generally. Yes, our commitment so far is pretty small, only 6 fighter jets, and we also have some special forces operators who are on the ground in Iraq assisting the Kurdish fighters there, but it's a very small number of them. I think there will probably be pressure on Canada to increase its participation in the war now. The thing that hangs over this prime minister is that when he was in opposition and there was a liberal prime minister, is that back in 2003, he famously or infamously perhaps supported Canada going to war and was very critical of Canada's decision not to join the coalition led by George Bush for the in that Iraq war. So there's a bit of a tightrope walk for him on this. I think there's an opportunity for him. Public sentiment is very strong right now. People have been very upset by this incident, and it's a question of how long they can sustain it and whether it will give him further leverage to increase our military role.
And meanwhile, there's something like 80-plus other Canadians that the government is closely watching, the same as they were aware of the two who turned out to be attackers. Glenn McGregor covers Canada's Parliament for the Ottawa Citizen. He's speaking to us from the CBC. Thank you so much, Glenn.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
Well, here in the U.S., we're just about a week and a half away from the midterm elections, which will decide which party controls the Senate and the House, even though there aren't very many who think the Democrats will be able to take back control of the House. Still, there are tough races being fought in districts all across the country, with the total price tag for the midterm elections expected to reach nearly $4 billion. That's according to new projections from the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. So let's get to this week's district profile. Each week we've been looking at a single congressional race, and this week it is a race that drew Vice President Joe Biden to Illinois this week to campaign for the incumbent Democrat Brad Schneider, who represents that state's 10th congressional district. Schneider is fighting to keep his job from Republican Bob Dold in a race that is a rematch from 2012. WBEZ's Katie O'Brien is covering the race. She joins us from Chicago. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And this is really the North Shore of Chicago, this district as well. You've got some fancy suburbs in there like Glencoe and Highland Park, but then also you've got more middle class areas like Buffalo Grove.
Full disclosure, I am actually from the district.
Ah.
So I grew up there, and it's changed a bit. There was a remap recently, and the North Shore, as it's kind of lauded in Chicago politics, is not actually included in the district anymore. So Kenilworth, where Bob Dold is from, is actually no longer in the district. This is just north of Chicago, about 25 minutes. You've got Walgreens, Baxter Healthcare, Abbott Labs, Allstate Insurance, and a lot of families that have been there a long time are invested in the area and in Chicago. So there's a lot of back and forth in suburban life and caring about metropolitan issues as well.
And we mentioned that this race is a rematch. Democrat Brad Schneider actually took the seat from Republican Robert Dold in 2012. They have both held this job and both are now criticizing each other's records. They met at a debate on Saturday, sponsored by ABC7 and the League of Women Voters of Illinois. Let's listen first to Robert Dold.
You say you're going to be bipartisan, yet have produced nothing but a partisan record, as noted by the Chicago Tribune and others, and are running a very partisan campaign. You said you wouldn't cut a single penny from Medicare, yet have gutted the program by over $700 billion. After you've misled the voters this many times, how can they expect to trust anything that you say?
So that's the Republican. This is the response from the Democrat, Brad Schneider, who says that the votes Dold criticizes are the votes he took to protect the Affordable Care Act.
I'll protect the Affordable Care Act because we need to move forward. And the National Committee to Protect Social Security and Medicare have said that the Affordable Care Act doesn't cut benefits to Medicare. Only one of us has voted to cut Medicare, and that's you. You voted for a Ryan plan, and you voted for it twice. And the Ryan plan ends the Medicare guarantee.
You know, what's interesting there, Katie, is that we don't often hear politicians talking this year about how they voted and are proud to have voted for the Affordable Care Act. A lot of them are trying to keep that quiet because it's not very popular in their district. Obviously, in this district, that is not the case. But let's talk about these candidates. And first of all, the Democrat, Brad Schneider.
So Brad Schneider was a big surprise in the district when he unseated Bob Dold. And he hadn't raised as much money as Dold, who had some big money and some big heavyweights behind him. in the last campaign. Brad Schneider is 53 years old. He's from Deerfield. He's a management consultant, but he casts himself as a small business owner because he owns his own firm. So, you know, he's of the people. Meantime, he has a wife who is a top executive at Mesirow Financial. They have a lot of wealth coming their way, and that's been an issue in the campaign. They're not disclosing their tax returns in terms of her income. He's very focused on education, on jobs, on saying that we need to build from the middle out, a champion of the middle class. But I don't think it would be fair to say that he is a member of the middle class. And that's something that the Dold campaign has pointed out quite a few times.
And what about Robert Dold? What should we know about him?
Robert Dold is also from an affluent family. His family owns the oldest extermination company in the country. He's from Kenilworth, which, as I said, used to be in the 10th district, but is no longer. And he is saying that if he wins, he'll move into the 10th district. But for now, he's staying put. Dold took over the seat from his predecessor, Senator Mark Kirk. He is still very popular in the area, and he's been appearing in ads with Dold. Both Kirk and Dold cast themselves as moderate Democrats and fiscal conservatives and talk a lot about how they're willing to work with the other party to boost the economy, boost America's reputation, both domestically and abroad.
And there have been some politicians coming in, some well-known politicians. We mentioned Vice President Joe Biden was just there at a rally, and President Obama was in Chicago over the weekend. Are these national politicians really playing a big role in the race in the 10th district?
Vice President Biden came out for Schneider. President Obama didn't really wade into the 10th district, but it never really hurts. He's still very popular in the district, and Representative Schneider is happy to talk about his relationship with President Obama. And Dold actually recently got a big donation from former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, which is kind of interesting because last time, as I said, Dold outraised Schneider significantly, but lost. And now Schneider is leading in total money raised, but he's spending it, whereas Dold is sitting on over $1 million cash on hand with less than 2 weeks to go.
And what are the polls saying?
The polls are calling this very close. It's 46-44. Schneider has a slight edge, but the margin of error is about 3 points. So this is anyone's game.
Katie O'Brien of WBEZ in Chicago talking with us about the race in the 10th Congressional District in Illinois. Katie, thank you.
Thank you.
And believe it or not, just one more district profile left before the election.
The millennial generation has been getting a lot of attention, including recently in NPR's New Boom series. Today, we wanted to hear how that boom, the sounds of millions of new baby boomers, the 20-somethings, sounds outside of this country's borders, in China, the world's most populous country and the second largest economy. So, from Shanghai, we're joined by NPR's Frank Langfitt. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Robin.
And with Frank is NPR's news assistant there and a millennial himself, 28-year-old Yang Zha. Hi, Yang.
Hi, Robin.
And Yang, we're calling this millennial series the new boom, but you've lived through another boom, the economic boom, most of your life, double-digit GDP growth. How has that impacted your generation?
You might expect there's a lot of optimism in China, but like their American counterparts, Chinese millennials are also under a lot of financial pressure. They hold entry-level jobs, but the society here is quite competitive. This year alone, China produced over 7 million college graduates. So we have just seen the slowest growth since 2009. But the home prices here remain at a very high level relative to people's income. So home purchase has become the biggest source of anxiety and pressure for millennials. And there's a shared feeling among them that they are feeling old, although they just started their lives.
Feeling old. Tell us more about that.
There's a Chinese word that young people here use to describe themselves. The word is house slaves. In this tradition, home ownership is what qualifies young people for marriage. So nowadays, people feel that they are enslaved by their homes, as if the single biggest goal in their life is to get an apartment.
So you're saying young people there are buying apartments, and is it men in particular to appeal to women?
Yes, if you want to get married, you have to own an apartment. Take myself, for example. I bought my apartment, two-bedroom apartment, last year, and it cost me $250,000. And 60% of my monthly income goes to mortgage, and my parents cleared their entire life savings on the down payment for the apartment.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure to ask that of your parents. What does that do to a relationship between a young person and their parents?
I have a very good relationship with my parents, and they both work for university, and they are on the internet and use social media. So you would expect that we may have similar views on different things, but sometimes I do feel that we live in different ages. There's one time when I had a conversation with my mother, people in North Korea, and she told me that she believed people in that country lead a happy and carefree life because everything is provided by the government. But I was stunned by that view because from what I learned, I know that people there, they're brainwashed and they have suffered from starvation. So I couldn't believe that my mother still holds that view in 2014.
Well, and now I got to ask you, what about, though, looking over to Hong Kong? I know you went out and did interviewing on this, Yang, and while you may think your mother has interesting thinking about North Korea, there are others who wonder what young people and people in China think about the young students, people your age, demanding free democracy in Hong Kong. What do young people tell you?
Through my reporting, I was surprised by the reaction from young people on the mainland. I was talking to this guy in his 30s at a prestigious school in Shanghai, and his view is that these young people in Hong Kong are spoiled. He said they can have a very good life in the embrace of the mainland. Why just stir up the trouble? And he even said that without the mainland, people in Hong Kong are just dog poop.
Dog poop. Well, that's pretty derogatory. Frank, I want to bring you in here. So Yang says many of his peers in China, disdainful of those in Hong Kong. And yet, how would you, from your observation, rate the millennials in China, you know, compared to other generations as far as being individualistic?
Well, they're a lot more individualistic than earlier generations. If you think, you know, this was a socialist country, you go back to the 60s. Back then, everybody had pretty much the same things and there weren't many ambitions. And now you see a lot of young people who have their own dreams and their own ideas of what they'd like to do. And what I found really interesting is I've met people in recent years who simply didn't exist. If you even went back to the 1990s, I'll give you an example. There's a surfer, a professional surfer that I met when I was covering a surfing competition on a river here, actually in eastern China. And he's from Inner Mongolia, which is landlocked. And just the idea that anybody in Inner Mongolia would have the imagination and ambition and drive to become a surfer is sort of extraordinary. I have another friend, also very unconventional. She is a bodybuilder. She's a weightlifter. She trains people in gyms. That's where I met her. That is just so different from what most young Chinese women would be interested in. And they want to be thin and slim, and that's kind of the ideal of Chinese beauty for women. And here's a woman who's very broad shouldered. So you see a lot of people kind of going their own way.
Well, Yang, what is your sense of what the future of your generation is in China? You've said you feel old. You're 28, you know, but everyone can relate to having, you know, a mortgage to pay. That can weigh on you. What do you see for the future of your generation?
I think as long as Chinese economy grows at a current pace or doesn't slow down too much, the vast majority of young people here will remain contented. I believe that some people will try to push the political limits, but most of them are very pragmatic. They're nowhere near the young idealists on the streets of Hong Kong.
Well, and Yang, one last question. We see so many Chinese students come to the U.S. Do you see them when they come back? Are they changed? Are they changing China from having been in the U.S., or is that just something we'd like to tell ourselves might happen? What happens when they come back?
My observation is now more and more Chinese students are coming back from the States. I believe deep down in their hearts, they do become more liberal, more democratic, but in everyday life, you cannot sense that. They're not taking government jobs because I think after the experience in the West, somehow their value system has changed a little. So they would prefer to go into private sector. It feels like China still remains as that old China.
Fascinating. That's Yang Jia, NPR's news assistant in Shanghai. He's the person who helps NPR's Frank Langfitt do his terrific reporting there. Frank, you're a lucky guy to have Yang. Thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Happy to do it, Robin.
And here's some more. The American research firm JWT Intelligence did a survey that found 74% of Chinese millennials said they'd be willing to start their own business if they couldn't find a job. They spend more money than their parents. Yang said there was an income gap. And more than half say that social media is an integral part of their lives. But of course, we would add many of the most popular sites are blocked.
A new poll from the Associated Press says that most Americans have some confidence that the U.S. healthcare system will prevent Ebola from spreading in this country. But they're not so sure their local hospitals can safely handle Ebola patients. And in some communities in the U.S., residents of West African descent are being treated with a stigma. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, KCUR's Sylvia Maria Gross reports from Kansas City.
Jenipu Balde has been calling her daughter in Guinea every day to plead with her not to leave the house.
So I always say, keep the kids in the house, make sure they are clean, do not go to any function. I mean, she can hear me maybe today and tomorrow forget, so I keep on calling every day.
Balde moved to Kansas City 10 years ago from Guinea, where the recent Ebola outbreak began. Members of her family there are either in quarantine or just staying home to be safe.
And us who are outside the country, we have to help. Financially, we have to help. Emotionally, we have to help.
Balde's taken a second job to be able to send them money. She also ships things like gloves and bleach.
It just breaks your heart because one way or the other, you are involved. You have your root there. You have most of your family there. And here you are sitting, thinking of all the ways to do. You feel like you are helpless.
A few weeks ago, Balde teamed up with some other West Africans in Kansas City to form the Committee Against the Spread of Ebola. Pete Jallo came up with the idea. He's from Sierra Leone. Jallo says they'll fundraise on behalf of groups like Doctors Without Borders.
And also we are here as a committee ready to help educate our own people about that Ebola is for real.
This service at a Lutheran church in Kansas City is in the Konobo language, a dialect particular to southeastern Liberia. Today, some other members of the congregation have joined the Liberians in solidarity.
So, we have come tonight as much as we can to share with Pascal. That's what family does, right?
Pastor Brad Zirkel's words are translated by Shadia, a lay minister. Dia says Ebola has not yet arrived in the Konobo region, but he and his countrymen are afraid. On Sundays, he gets on the phone in a big conference call with other Liberians from Konobo, and they talk with local leaders there.
We call certain people like the chiefs, the medical personnel, the commissioner, all to come on the line with us and tell us what is going on. That's how we get information.
Dia's community in Liberia may be safe for now, but the Kansas City community is starting to feel the stigma of Ebola. Cecilia Barler testifies that some of her co-workers at a local school have told the children to stay away from her. Dia says kids are being mocked too. And he says it makes no sense. Most of them have been in the U.S. for decades, and the disease was detected in Liberia just a few months ago.
So there could not be any disease carriers.
Even at the church, which has welcomed them, Pastor Zirkel says some congregants have asked to use a different communion chalice than the Liberians. Dia's fighting headlines, especially after the Texas cases that have gotten so much attention. But he has a plea to Kansas Cityans.
Feel free to shake hands, to talk with me, to embrace me, or any other Liberian. Because Ebola is not a Liberian sickness or virus that live in Liberians. No.
As for Genubu Balde of Guinea and Pete Diallo of Sierra Leone, they say they haven't felt any stigma at all, just the support of American friends who want to help. For Here and Now, I'm Sylvia Maria Gross in Kansas City.
Tom Ross, the president of the University of North Carolina system, is calling it a horrible chapter in the University of North Carolina's 225-year history. He's referring to the findings of that investigation that concluded that over 18 years, more than 3,100 students at the university, nearly half of them athletes, enrolled in classes they did not show up for. The report also says they received artificially inflated grades in a shadow curriculum that existed at the school for almost two decades. Former Justice Department official Kenneth Weinstein led the investigation.
They didn't take notes, have to stay awake. They didn't have to meet with professors. And the only coursework they had to do was to write a single paper.
And the academic fraud at UNC centered around the African and Afro-American Studies Department. Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He also hosts the podcast. What is wrong with me, Mike? I have not been nipping at anything. He hosts the podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. So give us some context here. You know, there have been other investigations. Put this one in context.
I will. And I'll just also offer you an excuse by saying this is a truly jaw-dropping report. And so maybe that's what happened to your jaw. Anyway, you know, the context is we have seen many an academic scandal over the years. But this, the contagion here and also the institutionalization of the scandal is all but unprecedented. So we may hear stories, you know, even members of the Harvard basketball team, a couple of them had to leave school for a year sort of to clear themselves, and scandals here and there and someone doing a paper. Essentially, they, meaning the cheaters, the people who wanted to get athletes by who didn't have the academic rigor to pass on their own, they essentially captured an entire department, as you say. This African and Afro-American Studies Department just became a very efficient system to give any student, athlete, which really is just an athlete, the grade they wanted. And they captured emails between members of the faculty and members of the sports team saying, what grade does the student need? Just a D? Well, I think I could swing that because, and then the person in the department would list all these shortcomings of the paper, including it's not at all about the topic I asked. And then the student would get the D. It's just quite incredible.
It's amazing. Not only were athletes steered to these classes, but they became popular with fraternities, you know, people who could pass the word around. This is the class where you can just get an easy grade. But there was complicity. You say these emails, people knew about this. Two decades. How is it possible that it doesn't go all the way to the top?
Well, I would say when your economic interests align with ignorance, it's power. It's pretty amazing how powerful a force that can be, and to keep people in the dark. And I don't know how high up it goes, but certainly there are people, the coaches of the teams don't want to know. They have an academic advisor who their job is to keep the players eligible. A lot of the basketball coaches have been there for a while. A few of those football coaches have cycled through. And so it's mostly a football problem because, you know, the roster of a football team is so big. But the men's basketball team, which won three national championships during the time this scandal was going on, they're caught up in it too. The women's basketball team, some other athletes. So yeah, I should point out that this investigation, UNC, there were stops and starts about how serious they were, and there was a whistleblower, a reading specialist. There was a whistleblower at UNC, and she had a tough time, and she essentially chose to leave school, but her accusations didn't really land on fertile ground within UNC faculty. And what she was alleging was academic fraud and just how they were admitting students who were illiterate, essentially, you know, who read on a fourth to eighth grade level. So that sets you up for having to, you know, how do you keep kids eligible at a really good school when they're just not at all able to do the work? Anyway, this whistleblower, her name was Willingham. She did not, you know, her word caused some of this to be investigated. It took 3 years. It was on the cover of the local newspaper in 2011. But this Kenneth Weinstein investigation really went so much further than anyone thought it would.
Yeah. And the school has announced that four staff members have been fired. Another five are under review. But just, we know this is part of a bigger picture. Taylor Branch, Joe Nocera, everyone talking about problems with college athletes in particular, and talking about athletes at other schools not taking classes. What's your sense, you know, of how UNC compares? Is it just much worse, or do you think other schools are now feeling a little chill?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know exactly how they compare. Every other school will definitely say, well, not us. It couldn't happen here. Of course, they said that about the Sandusky scandal in Penn State, and that exact scandal couldn't happen here. And maybe they're looking at how Florida State investigated domestic abuse, rape, kids or student athletes shooting people with pellet guns. And every other school says it couldn't happen here. So you have all these things that couldn't happen here, except some version of them are happening everywhere. Maybe it's the rot. Maybe it's the rot, the fundamental rot, the foundation of college sports, which are, we're going to make billions of dollars. We're not going to pay these kids. We're going to let them into institutions of higher learning, even though it's pretty clear that a lot of them can't cope with the work. And even if they maybe could cope with the work, we're going to make so many demands on their time to generate these billions of dollars that we're not really giving them an academic chance. I mean, you know, evidence, piece of evidence after piece of evidence really makes you question the fundamentals of the ideal of amateurism paired with this billion-dollar industry that is big-time college sports.
Well, Mike, let's talk about something a little more positive, shall we? There is a World Series going on and sport actually being played. Play resumes tomorrow night in San Francisco. After last night's game in Kansas City, the Royals won that 7-2. So the series tied at one game apiece of a win. After last night's game, the Royals manager, Ned Yost, praised his starting pitcher, rookie Yordano Ventura, for seven strong innings.
He did his job. You know, for me, in this type of series, you know, if you can get us into the sixth inning tied or with the lead, you've done your job.
In the other dugout, you have the San Francisco manager, Bruce Bochy, not smiling, but saying he was glad to be going home with at least one win in Kansas City.
Just got away from us there in the sixth. I mean, we couldn't get some outs, but, you know, you go home, I think you take a split.
Well, and the Royals scored five runs in a sixth inning to break that game, split it wide open. So, Mike, thoughts after two games?
Sure. I think it's interesting that both managers of the Bochy in game one praised his pitcher, Baumgartner, who was great. And then we heard Ned Yost praising his pitcher. The pitchers were good, but whenever a team scores seven runs, which happened in both games for the winning team, you got to expect they're going to win. And even though Bruce Bochy, I think, is one of the best managers in baseball, he made a mistake. He left his starting pitcher in too long, and the statistics show that Jake Peavy really does terrible the third time around the order. So when guys get to see him the third time, they light him up. That's what happened. Going to San Francisco, you know, the Royal starter, Jeremy Guthrie, is not that good. That doesn't seem to have fazed the Royals thus far. I don't know. I have no idea what to think, except the Royals are this magical team that will continue to surprise us, I believe.
Well, that's what makes it fun. Mike Pesca of the Daily Podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
This month, researchers announced they have used new satellite data to construct a map of the world's oceans. What they discovered was breathtaking. Thousands of undersea mountains and a ridge in the Gulf of Mexico under thick layers of sediment. The oceans cover nearly two-thirds of the Earth's surface, yet even in this era of Google Maps and GPS, very little is known about what lies beneath. Dave Gallo is an oceanographer and director of special projects at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He's with us from WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Dave, great to have you.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you very much.
Well, why is so little known still about the bottom of the ocean and what it looks like?
Well, it's vast. The oceans are thousands of miles across, 10,000 in some places. It's deep, you know, average depth 2 miles, greatest depth 7 miles. You need all sorts of sophisticated technology to go there to the deep in the ocean. We can't use GPS. We can't use radio waves. You have to bring your own electricity and power and lights and stuff like that. And the pressure can be thousands of pounds per square inch. So it's not an easy place to get to, let alone explore.
What about mapping it via satellite the way that we do a lot of the rest of the world?
You know, that's a fascinating thing. Typically, satellite information doesn't penetrate through the skin of the ocean, but people at Scripps have found a way to use altimetry data, the gravity of the Earth, to actually see through the ocean, quote-unquote, see through the ocean waters, and they've made a spectacular map of at least the major features of the ocean basins.
And then there is the mapping that is done with submersibles, right, that go right down there and take a look for themselves.
Yeah, it's a question of detail. So from the satellites, you get the big picture, you get the headlines. But if you really want to know what's going on, you've got to get in the water and in some cases get all the way down to the bottom.
So what do we know right now and based on these new maps of the world's oceans about what it looks like down there?
Oh, you know, it's a fascinating place, and for decades we've been studying the seafloor. If you took all the water off the planet, the most dramatic topographic feature on Earth would be this mountain range called the Mid-Ocean Ridge. It's a volcanic mountain range, 50,000 miles long, and it winds around the world like the seams of a baseball. And, you know, it's got thousands of peaks on it, higher than the peaks in the Alps or the Himalayas or the Rocky Mountains, the most rugged thing on the planet. And it's crisscrossed by thousands of valleys, many times wider and deeper than the Grand Canyon. So also the flattest places on Earth are beneath the sea. And we find underwater rivers. We find underwater lakes. We find underwater waterfalls. And in places where we said there'd be no life at all, we find more life and diversity and density rivals the tropical rainforest. So it's just one world of surprises. And the kicker is we've only explored about, 5, 6, 7% of what's out there. Hmm.
And what causes the topography deep down below the ocean? Because we know when we look at certain features above water that it was because a river carved through it or wind eroded certain parts of it. But in the ocean, it's all got water around it.
Yeah, it's called this thing called seafloor spreading. So actually, the continents are always moving around on the face of the Earth. And when they split apart, like Africa from North America or Africa from South America, it leaves a wound between the continents. And that wound almost never heals. And it becomes one big, long volcanic mountain range. So basically, it's plate tectonics causes the ridges, causes the trenches, the deepest places on Earth, causes the fracture zones, which are incredible fault systems like the San Andreas Fault. So it's all this thing called continental drift plate tectonics.
And we did learn about parts of the ocean that are called the Roaring Forties down near where the Malaysian Airlines flight 370 is thought to have gone down. There was a lot of mapping that went on there. Did that teach us anything about the ocean that we didn't know?
It sure did. You know, they're embarked on a mission to map a huge chunk of the ocean floor. I think it'd probably be the greatest single map at that resolution ever done. You know, I was a bit amused that people discovered that there was not only rough weather on top of the ocean, but that the bottom of the ocean was not flat like a fishbowl, that it had these incredible mountains at the bottom and valleys. And that's what was discovered. And it's spectacular, the topography there. Absolutely, positively amazing.
You led the search for the missing Air France flight 447 in the Atlantic in 2011. What did you learn then about what that part of the ocean looked like?
Sure. I was a co-leader of that. And the thing about that, it was left from Brazil, Rio, on the way to Paris and disappeared right over the top of that mountain range I talked about, smack dab between Africa and South America. And, that was a plane that people thought would never be found because of the rugged terrain. And in effect, we were looking for the plane and then the black boxes. So the mission was to try to find something, two shoeboxes, the black boxes, in topography that was much rougher than the Rocky Mountains, only at night with a flashlight. It would be similar to that. So we were familiar. The thing about Woods Hole is that we've been for decades studying that mountain range, and so we knew what kind of technology you needed. We had the team that had the talent to go out there and do that kind of mission, and we had the plans, the planning, the expertise in how to work in incredibly rough terrain. And I think those three things, and plus a little bit of luck and confidence, allowed us to find that aircraft.
We're speaking with Dave Gallo of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and you're listening to Here and Now. And Dave Gallo, how much of the mapping of the ocean floor is being done by research institutions like the one that you're involved with? How much of it is being done by commercial interests like, say, oil and gas developers? Or how much is being done because of somebody searching for something like an airplane that has crashed?
You know, all those different things that you mentioned, the three or four different entities, it's all different kinds of research with different kinds of goals and incentives. For science, it's always information. You know, we want to understand how this planet works. For oil companies, they want to know if there's any mineral resources there or energy resources. For planes or ships that go down to the bottom, you want to find something in particular. So, and there's not a lot of crosstalk between those different entities, but still all told, there's hardly any mapping at all. I mean, we're still down less than 10% of understanding what's out there beneath the waves.
Which countries are doing the most exploration?
Well, I think if you look at who's actually accelerating into the lead right now, China has come on incredibly strong. And they said they would, and they did. They've got the world's deepest diving submarine right now, a research submarine. They've made a commitment to build the robots and tools to explore the oceans and to become world leaders, and they're doing it. And so the U.S. has, we're sliding backwards a bit, in my opinion, And it used to be the United States, France, Russia, and now China's jumping into the lead in a big way. Japan's doing a lot of work out there as well.
Why are we sliding back in the U.S.?
You know, I don't know. I've never understood this, given the promise of the oceans. You know, there's one thing to explore the oceans. It's exciting. But we now know today that the air we breathe, the food we eat, the water we drink, all of those are tied to the oceans. Climate change tied to the oceans. And yet, you know, we've got this intimate relationship with this body of water on the planet that we don't even understand. And it's clear that there's an advantage to be had by understanding what's going on in the oceans. And the first thing we need to do is explore it. Yet we don't give it a lot of attention at all, and I just don't understand what more we need to do to make that point.
What do you still want to know about the oceans? If you could answer one question that you don't know the answer to at the moment, what would it be?
I want to know how it all works together, how the evolution of the ocean and the evolution of life on Earth, especially humanity, how it all comes together. And I think it works like a symphony, that there's cycle on cycle and cycle, and out of that comes human evolution. And I think that's a beautiful thing, and that's what I'm after.
What do you mean? Explain more about that.
Well, I think the oceans have always been pathways and obstacles to human evolution. So we had to come out of Africa. In fact, the nucleus of life, the cradle of life, probably along the East African Rift, and that's actually part of that underwater mountain range. It happens to be above land, but that rift system is part of this ocean system. And the oceans are driving all the things that control our environment. So everything that, from weather patterns to where it rains, where it doesn't rain, hurricanes, tsunamis, earthquakes, all those things tied to the seawater, energy from the seawater or the seafloor beneath the seawater. So there's this relationship between the energy of the ocean and the seafloor beneath it and what goes on land. And I love that, because if you look back in time on this planet, it's always been changing for 5 billion years. The face of the Earth has been changing, the climate's been changing, and it changes in rhythms and cycles on every scale, from the very large to the very small. And watching that, like a piece of music or a symphony, is the thing I find the most fascinating.
Dave Gallo, Director of Special Projects at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Dave, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And we've got links to the new maps of the ocean at hereandnow.org, as well as a slideshow and some TED Talks that Dave Gallo has given. It's all at hereandnow.org. We're a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.